Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and I want to thank you for joining us for another week on the show. So, today we will be speaking with Brian Balfour of the Civitas Institute about taxation in the state. We'll be having a discussion about taxes, which it doesn't sound interesting, but I promise it is, because when you get Brian and I together to discuss taxation, it tends to go an interesting direction for sure. Then we will speak with Dr. Robert Lipke about a non-education related topic, which will be a first on the show, our returning education guru. But before we get to that, of course, I want to talk about subscribing to the show, because subscribing to the show is the easiest way for you to listen to the show. When you subscribe to What Matters in North Carolina, you take out all the effort of going to the Freedom Action Network or following a link on Facebook to get to the show, and you get it directly to your device, your phone, your tablet, your computer, whatever that may be. By subscribing to the show, you get it there automatically. To do that, if you're an Apple user, go to Apple Podcasts, search What Matters in North Carolina. If you're an Android user, pick any of the variety of apps you can use to listen to podcasts. I use Podcast Addict myself, and you can go and search What Matters in North Carolina there and subscribe to the show. So that's how you can subscribe to the show. I touched on how you can listen to other episodes of the show or other shows in the Freedom Action Network. Again, that is by going to freedomactionnetwork.com, where you can listen to the NC Gun Dad show or the Free to Brew show, or just more episodes, the older episodes of the What Matters in North Carolina show. There's a lot of evergreen stuff in there that's not going bad and is definitely worth a listen. What comes to mind is segments with Representatives Mark Meadows and Mark Walker. Our segment with Nigel Farage was definitely an interesting one, and you can just go back in the archives and find those segments if you're interested in that. But again, all of that is about you hearing from us, but we want to hear from you. And to do that, all you need to go is on Facebook and Twitter and search What Matters NC, like our page, follow us on Twitter, and then we can hear from you there. But there is another way we can hear from you if you've been following along since last week. We started something new, and to help us talk about that, we are going to bring on Brooke Medina. So now, before we get into our segments for the day, I brought on Brooke Medina, who's been with us before, been on the show before, to talk about our newest outlet, our newest thing we're doing on the show, where we want to hear from you, and not just on social media, like I talk about every time, although Brooke is the one who is running the social media for What Matters, but we want to hear your voice, and we want others to hear your voice, too, through our call-in line. So thank you for joining us, Brooke.
Yes, thanks, Matt. I'm excited to talk about this and hopefully get some engagement with these listeners that we have. We would love to hear from them and get some of their feedback, but also their thoughts on some of the issues that we've been covering and hear their perspective.
I think it could be really interesting. And also, I think it's a way for us to know what people want to talk about. If we're on here talking about XYZ and they're calling up with ABC, we need to, you know, adjust course and talk about those types of things. And before we get too deep into it, I want to go ahead and throw that call number out there, as I will probably half a dozen times when we talk about it. It's 919-747-8063. You call in, leave a 1 or 2 minute message, keep it clean, concise. If it's good, we'll play it on the air for everyone to hear.
Absolutely. Because, you know, sometimes we get tired of hearing our own voices, and it would be nice to hear someone else's as well as their input.
Exactly. And I do have a certain amount of time to fill on this show every week. And if I can fill that time by clicking and dragging a great ranting voicemail into the file, as opposed to me talking for that time, I am all for it.
So are you saying you want ranting voicemails, or are you discriminating against happy and nice voicemails?
I want both. I want someone to call in and say, I want someone to say, hey, you know, I want to talk about this, or you talked about this on the show, and this is what I think. And it can be positive, or it can be, you know, this program is the dumbest thing ever, and we don't need anything like it, and it's awful. I'm not going to discriminate either way on good, you know, positive versus negative. Clean, concise, entertaining will make it through. Or if you want to talk about how much you love this show, those will probably make it through too.
Absolutely. Well,
if you hate the show, though, it's going to end up in the trash file. I don't know where it went. It's going to disappear.
Well, hey, you know what? I wouldn't be opposed to someone calling and just basically rapping the theme song to Fresh Prince of Bel-Air either. But, I mean, of course, it would be nice to, I guess, hear some North Carolina relevant thoughts and perspectives too.
I will put the caveat that if they do that, it has to be the entire song, not the abridged version that they started playing after the first few episodes. I want the scene with the airplane in there. I want all of it. I want the entire rap, word for word, verbatim, or it's not going to make it on.
Okay, so that's the challenge, everyone.
Yes.
We would love to hear your thoughts on the General Assembly, Governor Cooper, anything else happening in North Carolina, but especially the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air unabridged theme song.
Yes, and while we're on Fresh Prince, which you got me started on this now. So, are you a big fan of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
Oh, yes.
So, when Will's dad comes back and then...
You mean his uncle?
No, his uncle, his dad. The episode when his dad comes to Bel-Air and sees him and everything, and then is going to take him on a road trip for the summer, and then ends up backing out. Do you remember that show? Okay, well, it was the reason it's memorable. The reason it's memorable is because he backed out and left, and Will kind of tries to play it off at first, and then it kind of goes into this like big rant. Now we're talking about rants about like to heck with him. I don't need him. I learned to grow up without him. I don't need him. And then he goes at the end, why doesn't he want me? And he becomes very emotional. He's crying. His uncle is crying. And it that was a real moment because Will Smith's dad left him. And he had a very real emotional moment. And the guy who was playing his uncle recognized it. And they just reacted. But it was so good they kept it in the show.
Wow.
So that was a real moment.
I need to go on YouTube and look for that particular episode because I don't remember that one, but I would love to see that. I just, for the record, want people to know that even though you cannot see us here in the studio, I am really good at doing the Carlton though. So, I mean, I can bust some Fresh Prince of Bel-Air Carlton dance moves.
You know, he actually stole that dance move from someone else. I can't remember who it was. It was a music video.
But he made it amazing.
He did make it amazing. He did make it famous. But anyway, so we're going to have to go and move into our segment with Brian Balfour and I talking about taxation and getting into whether or not taxation is right, what kind of taxation or tax profile in North Carolina we have and whether or not we agree with it. And Brooke, thank you for coming on with us. And one more time before we get off, 919-747-8063 is the call-in number.
Can't wait to hear from you.
So now we will talk with Brian Balfour. All right, Brian, thanks for coming back on the show.
Good to be here again, Matt.
So last time we kind of pushed around or tossed around what we were going to talk about, and I guess now we're following through on that. We're going to talk about taxes. Taxes really focusing mostly on, I think, state taxes. That's a lot of what Civitas does is mostly state-based, and a lot of what we talk about issues and what matters in North Carolina, of course, is a state-based type thing. So I'm of the opinion that taxes, you know, what is it? Taxation is theft, I think is the
right
quick way to say it. But where do you land?
I'm largely in agreement with that. I mean, what right does the government have to forcibly confiscate some of your justly earned property? I mean, if you or I went around our communities and said, hey, you're going to give me 20% of your paycheck or I'm going to lock you up in a cage, of course. People would rightly condemn us as being thieves and being, you know, bullies and subject us to punishment. So then if government derives its rights from the consent of the governed, and we as the governed don't have a right to do that, how can we consent that to the government?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and actually the way you just phrased that so perfectly buttons into a show I'm watching on Netflix right now. It does. It's The Walking Dead.
Okay.
So this is on Netflix. So I'm a season behind everybody, I think, watching now. But there's this group called the Saviors. And what they do is they go to these other surrounding groups and they say, give us half your stuff or we're going to kill you. Or we're going to kill one of you. We're going to, you know, bad things will happen. We're going to put you in a cage, in a little locked up room. I mean, it really is this, give us half your stuff. Or else.
Right. Yeah. Sounds like they're starting the formation of a government on that show.
Apparently,
in
yeah.
That society. That's how governments.
They've got rules. No, they've got rules. You can't break the rules. There's penalties for breaking the rules. The guy's a little unhinged, but there's a certain establishment to how, what if you do this, this will happen type thing. So he's got a community. He's got a payment system. He's got different classes. I mean, this is his own little government he's created in this, you know, post-apocalyptic Georgia or Virginia or wherever they are in the South in the show. But, I mean, just the way you phrased it, it hit me immediately. I'm going, huh, that's exactly like what's going on in my TV show.
Right, yeah. Well, those folks must have been inspired by the U.S. government or the IRS. And
apparently.
Maybe. But, you know, taxation, you know, stepping aside from the kind of the moral component of it, which is certainly first and foremost in my opinion, but kind of getting to the economics of it as well, and especially at the state level, what we're talking about. And I know that you and I have kind of talked about North Carolina's tax structure, and we levy the three, you know, kind of big taxes here in North Carolina, the personal income, the sales tax, and the corporate income tax. And, you know, we at Civitas, we've been lobbying, if you will, for years, you know, advocating for the elimination of one of those, in particular, the personal income tax. And the angle we take on that is that that's going to make our state much more conducive for economic growth and opportunity. And, of course, all the jobs and the income growth that comes along with it. And there's tons of research out there that shows that the other states that are getting by without a personal income tax are really thriving. You know, Texas comes to mind. Tennessee has been seeing a lot of growth. And several other states, I believe there's 9 in total right now with no personal income tax. And Florida, of course, comes to mind in the Southeast region as well. And those are states that are attracting businesses. They're growing their populations. They're thriving. I mean, my goodness, all the businesses, you know, moving away from high tax California, moving to Texas and things of that nature, is really quite telling. And I think that North Carolina has been taking some good steps in that direction. We've seen the personal income tax. We've scrapped the multi-tiered kind of progressive income tax structure. We have one rate. Now down to one rate, we're lowering that rate. Now that one rate is lower than what the lowest of the multi-tiered rate was previously.
Right. So the state's out of money now, right? Is what it sounds like. You just say the state ran out of money, basically.
Oh yeah, completely broke. No. Of course, the opposite is true. We've been experiencing the last few years significant, multiple $100 million budget surpluses, continued revenue growth year after year. And a big part of that is, and this is even from the Fiscal Research Division, you know, their reports to the General Assembly saying, oh, we're experiencing some of these budget surpluses because income tax and corporate tax and all these tax collections are higher than what we had anticipated because of the more people are working, more jobs, you know, bigger paychecks. And that means, of course, you know, more tax revenue to the state. And unfortunately, kind of on the spending side, just for a second, the General Assembly has been doing some responsible things with that as well, you know, setting aside a significant portion into a rainy day fund, you know, for things like natural disasters, hurricanes, and of course, you know, an oncoming recession. That's, you know, these things are just a matter of, you know, when and not if.
Right. And what I think about, you mentioned California, how people are leaving California, and they, you know, known for such high taxes. I mean, I look at this chart from 2014, and it was 13.3% then. And now, so our income tax is below 4%, I believe, in North Carolina at this point, or below 5%.
I believe they got it down to about 5.5%.
Was it 5.4?
Yeah, like 5.499. Right. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, almost a third now of what this was in 2014. But I kind of reach back to when I used to see these commercials coming on TV, come to California, move to California. This is a California way of life, you know. Well, we're just, you know, skateboarding and surfing and sitting out in wine vineyards. And I'm going, no, your state is broke. California was appealing to people to move there because they were absolutely broke. And they had these high taxes.
Yeah, I mean, an absolutely gorgeous place to live, California, the climate, the beaches, and people are uprooting and moving to Texas. I mean, have you ever felt the heat and humidity in the Texas summer compared to, you know, Pebble Beach, California? Yeah, I mean, we can't say it's because of the weather. It, you know, taxes have an awful lot to do about that. And speaking of advertisement, you know, New York State, we're seeing lots of advertisements around North Carolina trying to advertise, you know, trying to recruit businesses and everything to come to New York State because they are trying to implement some program, some special, you know, tax-free or low kind of tax credit programs because, you know, they're recognizing, geez, we are absolutely bleeding jobs and businesses. We need to do something and to try to bring businesses back. So, you know, they're recognizing that they need to offer tax breaks relative to the oppressive tax rates they're applying on people up there.
I was about to say, when you first said they're trying to get people to move there, I'm going, okay, so you said they're going with the businesses. I'm going, there's no way they're going for, like, people because you know how many people we get in North Carolina who move from New York? It is ridiculous. I mean, just how many people who move from areas like that down to here, up in the Northeast, where taxes tend to be a lot higher, they tend to be a lot more restrictive in other ways as well. But kind of what I want to go back to is you talked about how we have all three. You know, we have the income tax, we have the sales tax, we have the business income tax. So, I mean, and I look at it whenever I think about this, I think about New York again, just to go right back to them, about their smoking laws or their taxes on cigarettes. They want people to not smoke cigarettes. So they go and they make this tax, this large tax on cigarettes to make them more expensive, to make people not smoke. Take that logic and go, okay, we have an income tax. What do we want people to do? We want people to produce and have a better salary and make more money, but we tax them based on making more money. So what is our tax going to do to that? And again, we don't have the same step-tiered system that we used to have. We have a flat income tax, but we're still taxing people and what they produce. If you're taxing me 5%, I make $100, you get $5. I make $200, you get $10. I'm paying you twice as much taxes. And what are we incentivizing here?
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the old saying goes, the more you tax something, the less of that activity you will see. And of course, the vice versa. You bring up the great point about the cigarette taxes. And, you know, liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call them, they seem to be pretty selective in recognizing that fact about taxation and the incentives put in play. You know, let's reduce smoking. Let's reduce carbon emissions by factories and other businesses. Okay, we're going to slap a tax on it. Let's grow. You know, how are we going to grow jobs then? Well, you know, take away the taxes on the jobs. But for some reason, they seem to think, we can tax, you know, businesses and job creation and productivity, and that's not going to have any negative impact on those activities. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of a head scratcher. You know, I think there's something beneath the surface that they recognize what they're doing, but they're pursuing a larger goal, and I think that's, you know, that larger goal more is like control. You know, they want to use the laws, use the tax system to control. Well, we want people to smoke less, so we're going to do this. So we want less carbon emissions, so we're going to tax that. But, you know, we want to make sure there's lots of revenue going into the government, so then government has a lot of money to spend on the programs and entice people to change their behaviors to achieve these, to receive these government benefits for all these other programs. So it's really just in large part, again, an attempt to kind of control people's behavior.
Oh, yeah. So I guess my overarching question is, you know, on a nationwide basis, I mean, you know, the states are experiments that you can use to apply to the federal government. And we talk about these 8 or 9 states or so that don't have an income tax. They don't have any sort of income tax on personal. I don't know about the business income tax. I don't know if Texas has one or not. But these states seem to be doing just fine. I mean, Washington doesn't have an income tax, and they're doing fine. Nevada doesn't have one. They're doing fine. I mean, these are successful states. This isn't some broken down, just bankrupt state like Illinois, for example, who does have an income tax.
Right, absolutely. I mean, you see some of the states that are in the worst fiscal positions, like Illinois and some of those northeastern states that you were talking about. Those are some of the states with the highest tax rates. We can't leave out the spending side of the equation, of course, which I think is a large part of those states' problems. And, they keep jacking up their taxes to try to keep up with the spending. Guess what they're doing? They're driving people out of their state. You have a smaller tax base, that's going to be less revenue. And then what do you try to do? You try to, squeeze that stone a little harder to try to get some more blood out of it by increasing taxes on those people who are remaining. And what that does to them, of course, it we talked about that before, the incentives, less incentive to work, less incentive to create jobs and increase your payroll because it's far more expensive to do those things.
Oh yeah, and it's not a system that can be sustained by any means. I mean, you're right. You're trying to squeeze more out of less to support this spending, and it's the answer is just so obvious in front of them. It's a way to get a handle on this thing, but I mean, I kind of go back to there's a bigger picture here. There's a bigger plan here. There's gaining control, and we talked about it with the light rail of. Why are you going to build this where nothing is? Well, because we want you to be here. This is where we want you to be. So we don't want the versatile public transportation system. We want the less versatile transportation system because we have a plan. We want this to not go so well and to give us the money as the government so that we can fill in these gaps that in a lot of ways that government's creating these gaps. I mean, it really, it's either total incompetence or there's a plan. And depends on what you think of the government, which side you land on, I guess.
Right. Well, certainly a skeptic might say that, the more people that are dependent on these government programs, the more those people are going to be likely to vote for those politicians who are promising them, to keep up and expand those government programs. You want to talk about money in politics. I mean, yeah, the big corporate donors and lobbyists and so forth, that's a significant influence. But the real money in politics is the trillions of dollars that the government spends every year in what some may label as basically kind of a vote buying scheme. Vote for us and we're going to give you this money. We're going to give you money for healthcare. We're going to give you money for food. We're going to give you money for, rent and so forth. And of course, then their opponent, they can demonize, say, my opponent wants to take away your health care, wants to take away money for your food or to care for your children. And it comes up every election time. And it's really, I think, in large part, just kind of boils down to that, a vote buying scheme. We're going to give you other people's money that we take from other people, we're going to give it to you. And in exchange, we're going to expect your vote.
All right, and in a state where, not a state as in North Carolina, South Carolina, but a wider view, a state, the state of things, in a state where we have income taxes in the nation that in some states are over 10% or approaching 10%, and there are more closer up higher to that number than there are that don't of the states that do have income taxes, we can just look back and remember that we went and started throwing some tea in a harbor over a 3% tax, Boston Tea Party. 3% tax, and we're the Sons of Liberty are raiding ships in the harbor, throwing this tea overboard, and now we're at a point where we're still just totally acceptant of this state where we're in now. We have a 5.49% income tax rate in North Carolina, and it's something to be nearly giddy about compared to where we have been.
Right, relative to other states, certainly, and the Tax Foundation puts something together. Called Tax Freedom Day, and they basically calculate by state kind of the average citizen's tax burden as a percent of their income, and they'll say, okay, that kind of equates to, 25% of your income is paid in taxes, so that means 25% of the year, a fourth of the year, 3 months of the year, you're working for the government, not for yourself. And in most states, I think it's later than April 15th, kind of ironically, even past the actual tax day, that you all that effort, all that time that you're putting in, that's not really for you or your family. That's going to someone else. That's going to the government.
Right. And last year, Tax Freedom Day was April 24th, ironically, just,
Okay. Yeah.
Almost, 9 days after tax day. Yeah. And they said it was 31% of the nation's income. 31%. So close to a third of the year working for the government. And I've never heard it put quite that way, in a way where you say you really are. You're working 31% of your work year, of everything you make, is handed directly to the government.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not by consent. That's by threat of force.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know anybody who enjoys paying their taxes. I don't know anybody who celebrates or sends in a thank you note with their taxes saying, thank you for this, for everything that you do for me in exchange for these taxes. I don't really get a sense of that from people. So it comes down to whether you believe in self-ownership or not. And for that one third of the year, we don't really own ourselves. We don't own our labor, our effort, our time that is being seized from us from the government.
Oh, yeah. And we have to get out of here on this segment, unfortunately, but I've already got our next tax topic in mind I want to talk about. And this is something that makes me really angry, and is paying property taxes on something I own. Why do I have to annually pay a tax for my vehicle? For my house, I'm paying my mortgage every month goes to my property taxes. I mean, why am I paying a tax on something I own? Do I really own it anymore?
Exactly. You're fooling yourself thinking that you actually own it.
Yes.
It's that rich uncle in Washington, D.C. is exerting their ownership over it.
I can take that Jeep out there, go set it on fire, and it is destroyed and gone, and then I'll still get a bill. And when the registration is up and say, hey, you got to pay his tax on this. So that can be our next topic if you want to jump in on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
But anyway,
I look forward to it.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, thank you for joining us for another segment on What Matters.
All right. Thank you.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. All right, Bob, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's good to be here, Matt.
And we're going to have you on for something a little different. You are, of course, our education guru here, coming on the Freedom Action Network on What Matters, but we are bringing you on for something totally different today, aren't we?
Yeah, today we're going to talk about minimum wage policy. And I'm sure people that watch the legislature know that just about every year there are bills to increase the minimum wage. And sure enough, that happened last year. And as it's been happening in a number of states, there was legislation this past session to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour to be phased in through 3-4 years, I think it is. And that bill also had with it a number of other significant provisions, which I think helped to sink it, including parental leave and sick leave for parents, and also a number of provisions, repealing the prohibition on collective bargaining, and reinstituting the income tax credit and a number of other things. But that bill did not get out of committee, but needless to say, I expect it will come back, because raising the minimum wage is one of the ways the left believes is the best way to alleviate poverty.
Right, and this isn't just an issue for North Carolina or people who've been paying attention to North Carolina. This is a nationwide issue. This is the Fight for 15 hashtag and organization. This is, going all over the nation with this idea that the minimum wage needs to be, doubled to $15 an hour. I think it's floating around $7.50 right now or so.
It's $7.25 in North Carolina.
Right.
And it varies, obviously. It should, as it should. The state has their own minimum wage.
Right, but it would double the minimum wage here in the state, more than double.
Yeah,
which would more than double the cost to every single employer who has someone on minimum wage, and not to mention the increase in the cost of the people who are at $8 or $9 or $10.
Yes, it has a lot of ripple effects, and that's some of the problem with it.
And that's one of the big issues is that money's not going to come out of thin air, come from nowhere. It's not as if these employers have this chunk of money that they're just sitting on. Their office furniture is not made of money that could then just go to this doubled cost of paying their employees.
Yeah, the reality is in most cases it gets passed on to the consumer. For example, if you're a restaurant your state where you're located passed the minimum wage bill, it gets passed on to your customers. That happened in Seattle. Seattle was the most recent state to pass a $15 minimum wage, and a lot of restaurants passed those costs on to customers. A number of them went out of business because they didn't want to do that.
And other ones went out of town, didn't they, too? Because it was Seattle only, so you can move outside of state.
That's right.
You
know, it has a lot of
jurisdiction,
a lot of ripple effects that most of the time when legislators pass these bills, they don't anticipate.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and that's just one of the things to my increased cost to the consumer. You know, you get a $10 cheeseburger becomes a $20 cheeseburger because you're paying for this extra cost. But that's not the only way it goes. It also goes with reduction in manpower. You know, you have to pay somebody double what you had to pay them before. You cut a guy. Then you have increase in technology where reduction in actual people, because you're using technology as an interface to have people order their food and reduce that position of a customer, a cashier.
Yeah, what it does is, and even in most cases, like in Seattle and in these other places where you actually get to $15 an hour, it'll be phased in over a couple of years. But the costs are still, in more cases than not, passed along to the consumers. And when that happens, and in a business sense, you're actually reducing the amount of money available for low-wage workers. So if the left is using a minimum wage policy as a way to lift people out of poverty, I don't know how you can advocate for that when one of the main impacts is to actually reduce the opportunity for low-wage workers. It just doesn't work. There are significant problems that come with these minimum wage laws that most of the legislatures just don't think through very well. And one of the things is, I mean, there are some practical and philosophical problems that we really should talk about. But if it's used, and this the left talks about, we have to raise the minimum wage because, you know, they'll trot out examples, which, I mean, are unfortunate cases, but they'll trot out stories of people that cannot survive on the minimum wage, and they trot it out as an injustice, you know, a failure of the free market, etc. And never is it said that the minimum wage was not intended, you know, to support households.
Exactly.
It was intended to provide, you know, a floor for low wage, low skilled employees.
Yeah, you're not supposed to stay on minimum wage. And I've, just from my own experience, and I've never supported a family or fully, you know, supported myself without anything else on a minimum wage job. But my first job in high school, washing dishes in a Cracker Barrel dish room, started at minimum wage. And I had, you know, a 50 cent raise at 6 months. And then there were steps from there on. My next job, I was working security at sporting events up at school at college. And I was not making a minimum wage there. From the beginning, it was like $8. But again, I was not doing that as a full-time supporting myself job. After that, working at a Subway, where I started there at minimum wage and moved up while I was there to some, leaving there at over $8, I think $8.75 an hour. But the fact is, like, I, who was not even using it to support myself at all, moved up quickly through these different built-in raises. So I did not stay for very long at 725 at all at any of the jobs that I've done that were jobs while I was in high school or jobs while I was in college. I wasn't at that level for long. And I can only imagine that someone who is working full time at this job to support their family, working their butt off, is going to advance quicker than I would think. The guy who's working it as a part-time job or as a high schooler.
Yeah, and you just brought up the other fundamental problem with it, with minimum wage as, you know, a policy to alleviate poverty. And that is in that minimum wage targets workers, not the poor. In other words, you just brought up an example of how, you know, people may both be at minimum wage, but they're not necessarily in poor households. You know, you can have a teenager working in a fast food store or a restaurant or something, and they can live with their parents and not be classified as poor.
Right. I mean, I was throwing gas in my truck.
That's right. Or, you know, in the case that's often highlighted, you know, I have a struggling mom. She's got two kids at home. She's kind of relegated to these low wage jobs that, you know, aren't going to provide enough to live on. And the rationale being, well, we should improve, you know, we should have raised the minimum wage and this will fix the problem. And that it doesn't, because the policy is targeted on workers and not necessarily on poor. And those two groups don't intersect sufficiently, you know, to make it an effective policy. So that's another problem with it. The other thing is, even like in North Carolina, we're talking about, there's a federal minimum wage, but even in North Carolina, I mean, most people can see that if you're living in Raleigh and Charlotte, the cost of living there is much more expensive than it is in Murphy or Wilmington or something. But yet at the same time, we have a state minimum wage.
Oh, yeah. If you're out in the mountains, $7.25 an hour goes much further than it goes in Raleigh.
That's
or
right.
Charlotte or Greensboro or any of the urban areas in the state. I mean, just looking at the housing market between Johnston County and Wake County is a whole different game. So someone who's in Smithfield looking for something is going to be able to find less expensive housing, whether they're renting or buying, than someone in Wake County is going to in Raleigh. And those are so close together. And that's not even, I mean, that just shows you that $7.25 an hour in one area is not $7.25 an hour in another. And we're not talking about New York to Raleigh, where you talk about a $100,000 salary is like a $50,000 salary in North Carolina, or that kind of exchange. We're talking about county to county, butting up, or a two-hour drive.
Yeah, but we are drawing that line and saying wage and the value of wages and the cost of labor is going to be the same in all areas, whether it's a high cost or a low cost area. And that makes no sense to anyone, but we do. That's the impact of actually drawing a minimum wage. We're saying the cost of labor or the cost that we're going to pay labor is going to be the same, whether it's a high cost area or a low cost area. And it makes no sense.
Right. And what that actually makes me think about now, and I haven't looked at it this way before, is so you have someone out in Western North Carolina having to pay the same minimum wage as the person in Raleigh. Doesn't that put a different burden on someone who's in a much lower money market paying his labor $7.25? And I'm not saying it's some high wage, but as far as the amount of money going into your business at a, we'll say, a Subway out in the western part of the state versus the Subway in downtown Raleigh. Does paying $7.25 to that worker in that market in the western part of the state more cumbersome than paying $7.25 to the person in Subway in downtown Raleigh? Do you see what I'm saying here?
Yeah, because, I mean, the fact is, and this applies even to a lot of schools. Schools are in different labor markets. Any community has a different labor market. And the one you described about whether it be in a you know, large city, say in Raleigh or a small area in Western North Carolina, saying you have to pay a certain amount for you know, an employee, you know, it's going to have a much different impact than in a low-cost area than it will in a high-cost area. So, yeah, I mean, it does impact things adversely. And, you know, when you stand back and look at it, this to me is really the biggest problem with minimum wage laws in the sense that it has all these shortcomings that we described, but the biggest one really is it impedes or takes away your freedom to contract with employees at whatever level you feel like. And why shouldn't, if I have a neighbor, high school kid down the street, you know, and he wants to cut my grass for whatever amount of money, I should have the freedom to contract that, you know, but technically the minimum wage is going to come into play.
Well, and also, I mean, the age he's allowed to start working.
That's
I mean,
right.
What is it,
that's
before
right.
16, you have to have, like, a signed permission from
yes.
your parents.
And so
or
what,
like
what
that.
Minimum wage does, basically, is take away from all these employers, small businesses, big businesses, the ability to contract for labor at whatever price they choose. And the government comes in and basically says, this is the price you're going to pay. And it distorts the price, the real price of labor, because what's the real price of labor? The real price of labor is based on the value that you bring to that process. And now that exchange, which is inherent in the market, you know, the government comes in and says, you know, this is the value, $7.25 for everybody at this, you know, this is minimum wage. And it distorts the price structure. As you know, it reduces the actual amount of labor or opportunities available to low-wage workers because, you know, of what the increase that employers have to pay. It distorts that. I also think it distorts incentives because the higher amount that employees get, I think they'll have less of an incentive to work harder and to seek additional
That's
skills.
True as well. If you can make $15 an hour flipping burgers, do you want to do anything else? $15 an hour, I mean, so the way they basically figure out what your annual salary is from what you have is you'll take your annual or your hourly rate, times it by 2,000 hours is kind of the ballpark way of figuring it out. So we're talking about a $30,000 job, $30,000 a year. My first job out of college was not $30,000 a year. That was I wasn't making that. And then I think now about my first job, my first official job, Cracker Barrel, 16, dishwasher. But that was, I started working for a neighbor a couple doors down before that for $4 an hour was what I was working. I was doing mostly cutting grass. And that was under the table labor. You know.
I think we're gonna have to report this.
No, I think we'll be okay. A kid cutting grass. I don't think anyone's coming after that. But anyway, so I was paid well under the minimum wage. Granted, there were no taxes coming out. It was all under the table. And I think when my brother worked for this same person before me, I think he was making less than $4 when he first started out. But the fact is I went and during the summer. I worked all day for this guy cutting grass, and I made some money. I made money, and I was happy to have the money that I made. I would work for that guy on the side up for, you know, years after that. Never making the minimum wage.
Yeah.
Into high school, I was working for him, and after I started driving, after I was at Cracker Barrel, I still worked for him sometimes. And it was just, I was making what made it worth it to me. It was worth it to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about really trying to expand opportunity here. I mean, the problems with the minimum wage is it doesn't do what it says it's going to do. It does not help people lift them out of poverty. It's got many shortcomings. many unintended harmful effects. And the obvious question I think people would raise, well, what should we do then? I mean, because you still, I mean, it's offered by the left as a way to help pull people out of poverty, and you still have that issue. And I think, I mean, really, we need to be able to respond to that. And the way we respond to helping people out of poverty is basically, you know, to take a holistic approach, which is, I think, it involves, you know, tax reform. We should encourage job creation, as I think we've seen in the significant tax reform legislation in 2013. You know, that spurred thousands of new jobs. People had more income in their pockets. Actually, I think the number of jobs created since 2012 was about almost a 500,000. So that's significant. A job is the best antidote to poverty. Economic educational reform. A lot of times this whole problem can be solved or alleviated or eliminated with a good education. The Opportunity Scholarship Program, charter schools, the new education savings accounts. These are good opportunities for kids that are stuck in troubled or failing schools to get a good education. And that's also a great way to break the cycle of poverty. So tax reform, education reform, you know, encouraging families, things like that, I think, are the best way to address getting rid of poverty, how you get rid of poverty. And I think if we come forward with substantive and significant proposals on those steps, I think we can take, we'll make a lot of progress and not be hamstrung with legislation that has many harmful effects.
Bob, we said we weren't going to talk about education, but you brought it back to education. You couldn't stay away from education, so we're going to have to cut you off now. You've slipped right back down into it. And
I apologize. And,
no, we'll let you back on again, but we're going to have to get you set in what you're going to talk about, I guess.
I just can't get away.
Although you did give me an idea for our next segment, and I want to talk about the disappearance and apparently coming rise and resurgence of trades, of vocations, not the four-year degree, going out, getting the vocation, and why that is so needed in the country. I'm sure you have thoughts on it. I have thoughts on it. And I think that could be a good segment for us next time. But we have to cut this segment off. So thank you for coming back on the show, Bob.
Thank you, Matt.
All right. Thank you, Bob, for coming on the show again. And we'll definitely make sure we get to that next topic we talked about coming up on a future show. Thank you to Brian for coming on the show and talking with me about taxation and about, you know, taxation is theft or how states get along without an income tax, all sorts of different topics to go on into about taxing. I mean, it's something that affects our everyday life, but we don't necessarily think about it every day, but maybe we should. Thank you to Brooke for coming on and helping me talk about our call-in number. This is the newest thing we are offering on the What Matters in North Carolina show, and we are offering you a voice in that. So to reiterate that, you call in to that number, 919-747-8063. Again, it's 919-747-8063. Leave us a minute or two message, something we can talk about on the show, or something you just want to rant about. It can be a positive thing, it can be a negative thing. Like I said, we're not going to discriminate based on that. It just has to be clean, fairly concise, and entertaining wouldn't hurt for sure. Something that people would want to listen to, and definitely things that I want to listen to are you guys, the listeners. I want to listen to what you guys want to say about the show. And that way, we'll know where to go on the show. But again, that number is 919-747-8063. 919-747-8063. Subscribe to the show. Make sure you're searching wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts or on an Android app. Search What Matters in North Carolina, and you'll be able to find the show and be able to subscribe and get it to your device easily. Go on Facebook and Twitter, What Matters NC, hunt down the show there and like our page and follow along with us on Twitter. That way you can keep up with us, and you can also talk to us through that as well. And go to the Freedom Action Network website and check out older episodes of What Matters in North Carolina, or look at the other shows on the network, the NC Gundad Show, the Freedom Brew Show, and we'll catch you next time.